And what I'd like to convey is that we see in the headlines of the newspapers all of these things about things that are being disrupted. And what I'd like for us to consider is that every time we see one of those headlines, it's like it's saying, Jesus is coming. The earth speaks of the end. So that's the idea behind the title. Hebrews 1, 10 through 12 speaks about how the earth is impacted by sin. And thou, Lord, in the beginning hast laid the foundation of the earth, and the heavens are the works of thine hands. They shall perish, but thou remainest, and they all wax old as doth a garment. And as a vesture shalt thou fold them up, and they shall be changed, but thou art the same, and thy years shall not fail. So we see that clearly portrayed there, that there is an impact upon the earth by sin. And here from the book Education, the same thing, page 26. Although the earth was blighted with the curse, nature was still to be man's lesson book. It could not now represent goodness only, for evil was everywhere present, marring earth and sea and air with its defiling touch. Thus, not only the life of man, but the nature of the beasts, the trees of the forest, the grass of the field, and the very air he breathed, all told the sad lesson of the knowledge of evil. And once again, Patriarchs and Prophets, page 67, the same. Thus were revealed to Adam important events in the history of mankind, from the time when the divine sentence was pronounced in Eden to the flood and onward to the first advent of the Son of God. Crime would increase through successive generations, and the curse of sin would rest more and more heavily upon the human race, upon the beasts, and upon the earth. Now that more and more, what does that tell us that we would see in terms of a progression to the time of the end, right? It would, this effect of sin upon the earth, we would expect to see becoming greater and greater and greater, and at its greatest as we approach the end. Amen? Now, what got me excited about studying this was a conference I attended. It was over New Year's at ASI in Orlando, Florida. I'm sorry? Yeah, GYC. And it was called The Planet in Distress. And if this stimulates an interest in you studying it more, there's a great book by Scott Christensen, who used to be one of the ADRA directors. And he lives up in Maine, and he's made this his study. And to me, it's just fascinating. And it's kind of, a new slant on looking at the signs of the end. Well, here are some of the systems that God has put on the earth at Creation Week. He designed these systems, and they're all interrelated, and they work together, and one impacting upon the other in God's design in favorable ways. We have this global food production system, a global climate system, a global oceanic system, a global fresh water system, and then we have man's systems as well, and they've been impacted. And one we'll discuss is the political system and the economic system. Well, let's discuss first this global food production system. Here we probably have plenty of food, right? But we know that, we see it in the newspapers, we see it in the news, that that's not the case everywhere in the world. There's a maldistribution of food, definitely. Well, back in the 50s, scientists that were studying the increase in food production, and then they were comparing that to the increase in population, and they saw the increase in food production going at a rate like this, but they saw the population going like this. Well, what's going to happen with those two lines? They saw that soon there'd be out of food, and so they started this term, the Green Revolution. Now, it's not what we're thinking of today in terms of the Green Movement. The Green Revolution was a kind of a systematic way and a political way and a developmental way and an educational way of spreading, exporting to the entire world what we had learned in the United States about high output farming. This involved mechanized tilling, artificial fertilizer, the use of insecticides and herbicides, and hybrid seeds. Now, hybrid seeds are much more productive than natural seeds. In fact, about 10 times more productive. But along with that tenfold increase, there's tenfold the resources that are necessary, and especially water. Now, underlying the plains states, you know about the plains states here in Kansas, right? Underlying the plains states, there's this huge but shallow aquifer called the Ogallala Aquifer. And all farmers have had to do is sink a fairly shallow well into that aquifer and all the water they need. Thus, this has become the breadbasket of the world. It's extraordinarily productive. And these farming techniques were so effective, and the export of them to other parts of the world, that was so effective, that food production just soared and looked like problem solved, right? Well, every time man thinks he's solved a problem through technology, there's generally unintended consequences. We're kind of learning that, are we not? And there were, with this export of high-output farming, there were definitely unintended consequences. There was this thinking that, well, if a little fertilizer is good, then a lot must be better, right? And over time, what has happened as a result of that thinking, since fertilizer that's left in the soil exists in the form of a salt, what do you think has happened to the salt content in the soils? Now, this isn't nearly so much of a problem here in the United States because there's been much less over-application of fertilizer. But this is especially severe in third world countries. The over-application has been pretty serious. So we see the soils becoming more and more salty. In addition to that, the insecticides have become more and more powerful in order to accomplish the same results. From the 1940s to the 1990s, crop losses to pests and weeds increased in spite of a tenfold increase in both the amount and the toxicity of pesticides and a hundredfold increase in the use of herbicides. The side effect of these powerful insecticides is that they kill the microorganisms in the soil. Now, the microorganisms in the soil are part of what's necessary by the plant roots to absorb phosphorus. So as a result of killing these microorganisms and as a result of the soil becoming more salty, which is also a factor in the microorganisms dying off, what have we had to do in terms of phosphorus application to keep our production high? We've had to use a lot of phosphorus. Well, eventually, the soil becomes unable to produce and becomes useless. This is a sobering statistic about that. All of the land that's been degraded and deforested and desertified, becoming a desert, since 1945 amounts to 45% of the Earth's vegetated surface. That's unbelievable, isn't it? That's amazing. Each year, more than 20 million acres of what once was forest has become farmland and now has become useless. 20 million acres of additional useless land occurs every year. And this process is so severe in China that you know what they're doing to find more tillable acreage? They've resorted to actually taking villages and moving them to land that once they were farming that can no longer be farmed. They move entire villages so that they can just farm under the land where the village was. That's how severe this problem is becoming in some parts of the world. Have you read about the depletion of the underground aquifers? How many of you have seen articles about that? I saw articles about it, and I just pretty much was unimpressed. I didn't really understand the significance of that. I felt that, well, there's not a net loss in water. So if water's lowering in one place, it must be raising somewhere else. So, you know, I didn't see that as an issue, but I didn't really understand the issue. Most aquifers, did you know, were created during the flood. And while some of the shallow ones have some degree of replenishment from rainwater, recently there's been much less replenishment, even than those that are replenished by rainwater, because of the changes in the weather. We have bigger rainfalls, more flooding, less vegetative surface. The vegetation allows the water to percolate into the soils. And so the result is, while we have a lot of water in a lot of areas, it just tends to run off. So it's not really replenishing. So really, these aquifers are a non-renewable resource that's being used up, and we haven't taken that into our planning. Farmers in China, a lot of this points back to China because they are kind of on the leading edge of dealing with these problems because they have such a huge population. But farmers in China who once put down shallow wells and had all the water they needed, a few years back had to deepen those wells. And then, in shorter interval, they've had to deepen them even more. Now they are putting down, a few years back, they were putting down wells as much as 400 feet deep. Now, if you put a well down 400 feet deep, where does the pump have to be? You can't draw water up more than 33 feet. So the pump has to be down at the bottom of the well because you have to push the water up, right? Now, if you're going to put a pump that's capable of putting a lot of water and pushing a column of water 400 feet, how big does that pump have to be? So it has to be a big pump. Now, if you're going to put a big pump down a well, how big does a well shaft have to be? Can you see that these wells are getting really expensive? Now, what happens when these 400-feet wells go dry? They are in serious trouble. There's a huge amount of their farmland that does not receive enough natural rain to support the crop yields that they need to feed their population. China is worried about this. That's why they built that huge dam project. I wasn't swearing. I was talking about a dam. So what happens when these wells run dry? That's a pretty good question. Remember me mentioning the Ogallala Aquifer? That's really important to those of us that love Kansas, right? And I count myself amongst those that love Kansas. That's really important to us here, isn't it? That Ogallala Reservoir, because it underlies most of Kansas, actually. Well, the wells around the edge of this aquifer, guess what? They've already gone dry. The Ogallala Reservoir, or aquifer, is shrinking. It's being overpumped. It's being pumped much, much faster than it's being replenished. It's extremely slow replenishment into that aquifer. Do you know that the scientists have predicted that the Ogallala Aquifer will be completely pumped out by 2035? Now, lest you think that's a long ways away from you, do the math. What's 14 from 35? How many years? 21 years. It will be dry, but think of this. Long before it's dry, there's going to be significant problems. Long before it's dry, there will be arguing and there will be problems with people trying to compete for this precious resource. Can you imagine the entire Plain States as a dust bowl, incapable of producing anything any longer? And much worse than that thought is the fact that this is happening all over the world. But what are our options? On average, it takes 1,000 tons of water to produce 1,000 tons of wheat. If we're running out of water, then what are our options? We can't produce water. We can't inexpensively move it from places where it's plentiful. What are our options? Well, perhaps we could move where we're doing the production. I'll speak to that in a moment. Perhaps we could get away from hybrid seeds, go back to the natural seeds that do pretty well with natural rainwater. Could do that. But our production would plummet. It would be about 10% of current production. We would almost instantaneously, by switching to hybrid seeds, have an inadequate food supply. Here's another thing to ponder. The price of oil and the price of food are directly correlated. It's really interesting. I saw at the seminar a graphic representation of spikes in oil price over time. And then I saw another one. I tried to find this to put it up on the screen, but I couldn't locate it in time. But I saw another one, same chart over the same period of time, except it was over the price of food. And you take those two charts, put them on top of each other, perfect correlation. Every time the price of oil spikes, the price of food spikes. If the price of oil goes up 100%, price of food goes up 100%. It's amazing. Now, this has been happening over the last several years, but we haven't noticed it. The reason why we don't notice it is if you go to the grocery store and you're used to picking up a box of cornflakes and paying $4 for it, and I don't know, that might not be what the, is that about what they cost? Okay, you take a box of cornflakes for $4. Well, how much of that $4 is actually related to the price of corn? Maybe 10 cents. So if the price of corn doubled, you add 10 cents to $4, do we even notice the difference? We don't notice it. But what if you're a poor farmer or a poor person existing somewhere in a third world nation and you're living on $2.50 a day, and you go to the market just to get a handful of grain to feed your family, and the price doubles. You go home with half as much grain to feed your family. The poor people of the earth are being dramatically impacted by the price, by these price spikes in food. And that even is occurring when there's still sufficient water to grow it. Of the 7 billion people on the face of the earth, how many people? 7 billion people, 3.5 billion. Now, what percentage is that? Half of the people on the face of the planet live on $2.50 a day or less. There's about, I think there was about 1 billion that live on $1 a day or less. Now, in normal times, that what I mean by normal times is the price of gas, or the price of oil. If the price of oil is about normal, during those times, about 15% of the people are malnourished. They're significantly, there's a significant degree of lack of food that they're able to purchase. So imagine that if you were to live in one of these third world countries and your level of dissatisfaction with the political landscape is pretty high. You're going along, you have this level of dissatisfaction, your life isn't going so well, but all of a sudden the price of oil spikes and you can no longer buy enough food to keep your children from having hunger pains. And then there's some people that come in, those agitators we talked about last night, and they fire those people up and they promise them some change. The price of oil, brothers and sisters, is directly related to the degree of conflicts around the world. Because when people are hungry, they're very prone to wanting to overthrow their governments. How many of you knew that that's what caused the current problems in Syria? One of you did. Two of you did. Three of you did. Four of you did. Okay? Five of you did. Okay? Five out of the whole congregation. I didn't know that until I went to this conference. I didn't realize until I saw that graphic of the price of oil overlaid upon conflicts around the world, that there was such a direct relationship. I knew there were people that were starving, that were hungry, but I didn't realize all these factors involved. So add together the fact that we have less and less tillable land on the earth. We're losing the war with insects. Our tillable land is becoming less and less fertile. We're running out of water for irrigation. What do you think all of this is going to do to the cost and availability of food? What do you think? And if you think, like I do, that food will become increasingly unavailable and, of course, more expensive, then what do you think is going to happen to the degree of conflict around the world related to the shortage of food? It's easy to see what's in the future. Matthew 24:6-7, though, Jesus' words, "For nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines, pestilences, and earthquakes in various places. All these are the beginning of sorrows." But that's not all. Another essential ingredient in the way we produce food is phosphorus. I had mentioned that a little bit earlier. Certainly we have lots of phosphorus, right? Wrong. Increasingly, maintaining supplies of phosphorus is really factoring into the strategic planning of governments around the world. 90% of the entire world's resources of phosphorus comes from only 5 countries. We need 17 million metric tons per year of phosphorus for our current levels of food production. And the production of phosphorus peaked. And by the way, that increases by 3% a year. Our production of phosphorus peaked way back in 1990 and has been in decline ever since. Now, if our need increases by 3% a year, but our production is declining, what does that tell us? There's going to be problems soon. We're not going to have enough phosphorus, and we need it to produce enough food. In fact, it's been estimated by those that do the planning for the future, actually by a subsection of the United Nations, they've estimated that there will be complete exhaustion of global phosphorus by the year 2040. Now again, like the depletion of the Ogallala Reservoir, there's going to be problems long before 2040. As it becomes more unavailable, nations are going to be going to war to secure their supplies to ensure that they can feed their people. Well, that's global food supply. What about oceans? Years ago, I remember people talking about how we could feed people from the richness of the ocean. In fact, about 1 billion people get their primary source of protein from harvests from the sea. But the quality of our oceans has become more or less in steep decline over the last 50 years. During this time, there's been substantial changes in ocean chemistry and water temperature and the viability of shallow water nurseries, which provide for all of the things that are eventually harvested. Trying to maintain the enormous amount of fish that we take out of the ocean has resulted in more and more resources. Bigger boats have to go farther and farther and fish deeper, and they're taking species out of the water that they didn't used to have to fish for. Why are we having to go farther? Why are we having to fish deeper? Why are we having to use bigger and bigger rigs? Because we've overfished. We're depleting a resource that, while it's renewable, we're taking it faster than it's renewing. We're over-harvesting and we're depleting whole species of fish. Add to the over-harvesting the fact that the oceans are dirtier, the fish are being impacted by the changes that we see that I discussed And add to that the worry of the long-term effects of the radioactivity. That now these fish are exposed to as a result of what happened in Japan. All over the world, scientists have grown concerned about the death of reefs. These are the nurseries for the entire ocean. When the reefs die, so does the ocean. Consequently, obviously, the oceans are not the answer to the global food production problems. Global sea harvest peaked in the late 1990s at about 85 million tons per year, and it's been in decline ever since. This shows the collapse of the global fish stocks. The vertical axis is percent of species collapsed. Interesting chart, huh? Another thing affecting our oceans is our production of carbon dioxide. We are, as an oil-burning planet, we are producing a lot of carbon dioxide. And you might wonder, well, you know, scientists have been predicting that all this carbon dioxide was going to cause tremendous global warming, and there's a lot of arguing over whether that's occurring. Well, part of what threw off the models that the scientists were using is they didn't account for how much the oceans were absorbing carbon dioxide, but now we're beginning to see that. If you take water, H2O, and you combine it with carbon dioxide, what do you get? H2CO3 carbonic acid. Carbon dioxide that's dissolved in the water increases the acidity of the ocean. Does that sound like a good idea? It's not a good idea. It's causing changes in the pH that are, especially in recent years, noticeably measurable, and it's occurring over the entire oceans. Recently, oceanic acidification has reached such a state that they're beginning to see it affecting shellfish, dissolving their shells. And obviously it's affecting the coral reefs. We've probably all heard about that. Another problem is that when fertilizers run off the soil, they run into the rivers. The rivers run into the ocean. The excess fertilizer there then results in an algae bloom. The algae die, sink to the bottom. The bacteria feed on the algae and consume the oxygen in the water, leading to really low oxygen levels, resulting in a dead spot right there. These dead zones are found in the Gulf of Mexico, where our rivers run into it. There's actually, at last count, more than 500 of these dead zones around the world, with 200 more on the way. That's significantly worse over the last 10 years. Our oceans also serve as a giant heat distribution system. The heat distribution affects our global patterns, and in the past have kept them relatively stable and predictable. Predictable enough that we could afford to build infrastructures for producing food based upon the predictability of the weather. Well, recently scientists have noticed that these currents are changing, and with that change, we're beginning to notice significant climate change. How many of you believe in global warming? Oh, wow. A lot of you do. I don't know whether it's occurring, but I think no one disagrees that there's global climate change. No one argues that. That's pretty evident to all of us. So we see one of the causes to that is this change in how the oceans distribute heat. Also, we've got a problem with the oceans are rising. We know that our coastal cities are going to be, many of them are going to be visited by God's judgments. Could this be one of the methods that He would use? When climate change, storms, droughts, heat waves, pestilences, and disease that did not previously affect our societies, they're now suddenly making a profound impact. Put another way, climate change destabilizes our society, destabilizes our systems. The way that we live is going to be impacted more and more. And it's going to significantly increase costs. And it's going to increase our food production. increase our food production problems. In other words, our cities, our farms, our roads, our bridges, our dams, our levees, our electrical grids, our water distribution systems, they're all located and constructed where they are under the assumption that conditions would remain relatively the same over time. Can we adjust as conditions change? We seem to have a great deal of confidence in our technological prowess. But I would say that these changes are occurring much too rapidly for us to adjust to. And they're going to be profoundly expensive to adjust to. We can't afford it. I can't overestimate how big of a deal this is. Think about just what's in this area. You know, if you look out there, what do we produce in great quantities around here? A lot of grain, right? Okay, you have an infrastructure that's built around the production of the grain, the storage of the grain, the transportation of the grain. All of that is located in this area because here's where grain is grown. What would happen if grain could no longer be grown here and all of a sudden the ideal place for growing grain is in Georgia? It would take years to move all of that infrastructure over to Georgia, wouldn't it? It would take a long time to adjust to such a substantial change. We have built our entire infrastructure with the assumption that things were going to be predictable. On the screen, there's a chart of droughts in the United States. I'm sure you've heard of how Lake Mead is drying up and how California is under water restrictions and there's problems all over. These problems are worldwide. They're not just here affecting us. And as I mentioned, there's a lot of controversy over whether or not there's global warming, but pretty much everybody agrees there's global climate change, and we're beginning to see it as really significant and really affecting us more and more. There's greater variation from what's normal than we've ever seen before. Here's a chart that shows weather catastrophes from 1980 to 2012. What's the trend? There's 2.8... How many people are on the planet today? 7 billion. There's 2.8 billion people that are already facing water scarcity. That's 40% of the global population. And that number is going to increase. Currently, 1.2 billion people get their water from melting snow and melting glaciers. Well, the glaciers, as we've all heard, are melting, right? So right now, they've got plenty of water. But what happens when those glaciers are gone? What happens to those people that are dependent upon that melting water? And coastal cities with burgeoning populations have been overpumping their aquifers. Now, their aquifers lie close to the ocean. So what is happening is you've got ingress of salt water into their aquifers. And that ingress is to the point now where it's easily measurable. Lake Mead is a source of water for 22 million people in the southwestern United States. It's dropped 125 feet in a 14-year drought. Another 80 feet and the water level will be below the water inlet pipes. That's why Las Vegas is spending all kinds of money to build a pipe that taps in at a lower point. Israel depends upon, for much of its water, depends upon the Sea of Galilee. The sea is in rapid decline and soon will have dropped below the level of the inlet pumps. Same problem. This is global, these problems. So we see a distress in all of the systems that God created. He put into play, they were to remain stable and interrelated with each other and support us permanently. He designed them to be eternal in their capabilities. But because of sin and because of man, especially because of man's recent technological inventions and so forth, that these systems are in rapid decline. They're all under serious attack. So we see the decay of global food production systems, the decay of global climate systems and the oceanic systems and freshwater systems. We see that the effects of sin are rapidly coming to a head. Well, let's now take a look at some of man's systems. One system we're very dependent upon is our economic system. And the economic system, it's become globalized. You can't have a problem in one part of the world without it affecting other parts of the world. And we've all heard about how the whole European Union is being impacted by some of the countries that overborrow. We see always of Portugal and Italy, and we see the problems in Greece. That's really impacting them. They're really worried about it. They're spending all kinds of money trying to shore these governments and these systems up. But one thing that strikes me as I've studied how the economy works is that it's very dependent upon the thinking that tomorrow is going to be better than today. Have you ever thought about that? It's kind of like a house of cards. If enough people think that tomorrow is going to be better than today, the markets rise. Now, when enough people become frightened and think that tomorrow is not going to be as good as today, then they try to sell, right? But there's always the bottom feeders there that they want to take advantage of the selling, and they're going to be doing some buying at the time, and that keeps the markets from going down too far. But what would happen if pretty much everyone thought that tomorrow was going to be worse than today? There's no end to how low it will go. Everything would collapse. All it would take is for some terrible event that just scared everyone. Like, for example, a city being destroyed. We're told that God will soon be visiting judgments upon the cities. And I think very soon. In other words, for our tightly interlinked global financial system to keep working, it's necessary that the world continue to function more or less normally. The climate, crops, water availability, number and intensity of storms, and so forth, they need to stay more or less the same as they have in the past for our global financial system to be healthy. After all, why do you think it's unhealthy today? Because we see all of these things changing. Bible-reading Christians know that in the time of the end, the age that we're now living in, that the world will not function normally at all. This chart shows natural disasters which were reported between 1900 and 2011. Now, while there's been a little bit of a tapering off there in the last few years, what's the dramatic feature of that chart? Almost a logarithmic type increase, right? The United States, the largest economy in the world, is drowning in debt. And we have no fiscal self-control. Japan has had a... Remember how we studied Japan? You know, the Japan of the 1980s, business schools were studying in the 1990s because they seemed like it was an economic juggernaut that, in fact, we were afraid of the Japanese, that they seemed to be buying everything up. They've had a stagnant economy. Now, when have you last heard about anything that would make us fearful of the Japanese? It's been a while. And they're reeling from the costs associated with dealing with their earthquake and their tsunami and the nuclear accident of 2011. The European Union, as I mentioned, it's staggering from a series of financial blunders and mismanagement, especially on the part of some of the nations that have been less risk-averse. China, the world's second-largest economy, they're fighting both a recession and inflation at the same time. And they're also fighting massive corruption and fiscal mismanagement on the part of state-owned companies and real estate speculators. Our political systems here in the United States, are they working? Not very well. Americans seem too uninterested to bring discipline to our political system. We keep voting the same people and over again, in spite of the fact every single poll says we're dissatisfied with them. Does that make any sense? Why do we do that? our justice, and if Americans are interested, they seem too ill-informed to be able to make good choices. Our justice system is bent on destroying our Constitution, and political correctness and anti-Christian sentiment is just running amok. The whole world seems to have gone insane. All the while, we anesthetize ourselves with all kinds of instant gratification and entertainment. Is there any good news? Not from a human perspective. There's no good news on the news. But on the second thought, what we spoke of earlier, these news headlines really are good news because they say, they proclaim loud and long that Jesus is coming soon and very soon. Why? Because man is destroying the planet. For the first time, he's had the capacity to do so, and he's doing it with gusto. Please come soon, Jesus. Amen? Cindy?